Today is Wednesday. It's February 7th, 2024. And hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which are broadcast Saturday nights on WGN Radio. And that's where you can hear me weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Flies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now writing the Chicago history website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Marge Halperin, political pundit, commentator, and activist with Indivisible Chicago by day, communications consultant.
I'm Eric Zorn, former member of the Tribune Union and former columnist at the Tribune. I now write the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly newsletter.
I wonder what the metrics were on the work stoppage on the one-day strike last Thursday that the members of the Chicago Tribune staff had. Did you see any fallout on that?
I didn't see any numbers, and I'm sure they don't make those numbers public. I got to maybe ask around, see if any sources that I still have in the newsroom might be able to know. I'm sure that they had some drop because it was not a big news day anyway. They did put out a paper on Friday, and it was the same length as the usual Friday paper is. It had intern copy, it had wire copy, it had freelance copy. I don't know if someone who hadn't heard of the strike would even notice that it was a thing. And certainly the Tribune itself did not cover the strike, which I thought was infamous, actually. I'm very critical of their decision not to even mention it. The Washington Post wrote about its own one-day strike.
I noticed that. Do you think that came down from the top? Said do not mention
this? I would imagine that it did. It did not, however, prevent Mitch Pugh, who's the executive editor, or Phil Jurek, the managing editor, or Par Ritter, who's the essentially the publisher, from issuing some sort of statement on social media, just kind of adverting to the fact that they support their newsroom and their people in the newsroom who haven't been given raises in like 6 years and whose 401ks or contributions are being taken away. And who are struggling, a lot of them. I heard about one of my former colleagues was driving an Uber in his spare time to make enough money to make ends meet. And I feel like the newspaper's failure as a publication to cover what was obviously and arguably a relatively big news story in town. It was on every other publication, every other electronic media outlet. WGN covered it, both AM and the TV station. And for the Tribune to ignore it, and that is a piece of news that is more vital to Tribune readers than anybody else. And they ignored it for some sort of corporate benefit. And that's an abrogation of their journalistic responsibility. You got to cover the stories. And if you don't do it without fear or favor, what good are you? If the readers have to look at this and say, is this being filtered through the lens of what a bunch of hedge fund overlords in New York want them to publish? That's a question you don't want readers asking, and that's a question that you've got to be asking after this kind of decision. I'll get off my soapbox now, and we can have the podcast as
you wish.
I think
that was pretty good. Sun-Times had the story. We interviewed some of the principals on the radio. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. I didn't even notice, to be honest with you, that the Tribune hadn't covered it. But touche, Eric. Well done.
What do you do as a reader besides a one-day strike to protest? I remember when the Sun-Times laid off its entire photography staff. I canceled my subscription. I was like, that's it. I will not give money to them anymore. And I, fired off a letter about it, which obviously no one ever read. It made no difference to anybody. And some years later, I came slinking back going, I don't want them to go out of business. I'll resubscribe. It's such a catch-22. Mm-hmm. What do we do as readers?
Well, that's a really good point. And with something like the Sun-Times photography staff, I think that they did notice that you had canceled, Kate, because they did ultimately hire them back. So I think you are very effective.
Good job,
in that.
Kate. Good job.
Thanks. Okay, I'll keep it up.
Thanks, Kate.
The union did not urge anyone to cancel a subscription. They just urged a one-day boycott. They wanted to show their power, flex their muscle. I hope that it did impress Alden. I don't think it did. But it's what else can they do? They're sort of powerless. And I'm afraid that having a newspaper strike is very difficult in this internet age when you can have freelancers just kind of contributing stuff over the transom. You don't have to have a newsroom as such. In fact, I don't know the Tribune's going to even have much of a newsroom after Bally's kicks them out of the printing plant, which is supposed to happen in a few months. Maybe they'll be working out of coffee houses like some of the suburban reporters do.
Larry, I was reading about the closing of some newspapers and magazines, Sports Illustrated and some other the newspapers across the country were in the headlines the last couple of weeks. And one of the analyses I heard was that a lot of these newspapers, say the Chicago Tribune, are still profitable. It's that they're not profitable enough for some of these business ventures. Is that true? And is that a fair point?
Well, you know, they don't open their books to me, but I understand that they are all in this hoping for a 20% profit margin. That's what they said when they took over the paper. And like I said, they don't open their books. It's not a public company. They don't even return phone calls from reporters. So we don't know. To circle back a little bit to this, I mean, I think, yes, the answer is yes, they are profitable still. And they will hang on until they're no longer profitable. And they'll dump them because Alden is a money firm. It's not a journalism firm. And they don't care about journalism. They don't care about their civic obligation. They want to put out whatever product is going to make the most money for
right,
them.
But journalistic firms should care about being profitable, too. I think that's not unimportant.
Well, for years, there hasn't been a conflict like that because newspapers were printing money with classified ads that are no longer there and movie ads that are no longer there and a lot of car ads that are no longer there and real estate ads that are drying up and things like that. So but just to get back a little bit to this question about subscribing, I think you do have to support your local newspapers and your media outlets by subscribing to them and keeping them healthy. And certainly we do, and I hope that the listeners to the Mincing Rascals do, even though you've got misgivings about the publication itself, even though you don't support everything they do, even though you don't like their editorials sometimes. It's part of what, you know, you want some of these reporters, you want A.D. Quigg in City Hall, you want Fran Spielman in City Hall, you want these, you know, you want Greg Hines, you want these reporters asking the tough questions, holding the politicians to account, keeping an eye on them. If those kind of publications dry up and you're just left with really small newsrooms and places that don't have the resources to do the investigations and follow up the way the bigger newsrooms do, your city is going to be in trouble, and citizens are going to be in trouble, and taxpayers are going to be in trouble. And the people who are going to be having a big party are going to be people who are, are corrupt, the thieves, the bad guys, the rascals, rascals.
It is about supporting the journalists. That's what I tell people. And they say, oh, I don't subscribe. That paper made me mad about this or that. Certainly the endorsement of Gary Johnson cost Tribune some of my more liberal friends subscriptions. But I say what you just said, Eric, that I do think you have to support the journalism. Being a two-paper town is a rare gift for us as long as both papers can prosper.
So the answer is we're completely powerless.
Well, my attitude about it, I read the papers pretty regularly. That's a function of my job. I'd like to think I did it anyway because I want to be an informed citizen. But my mindset is support the journalism the same way you support a library or a museum you don't go to every day. Is it good for the city to have it? Yes, it is. Somebody's going to read it, and the politicians will pay the price for it and will benefit if we don't have it. So the same way you want the roads paved or to have world-class museums, you know in your heart you need the Tribune and Channel 11 and WGN Radio and so on and so forth. It's just an investment in our community. That will not sell, however. I mean, I know that to be the truth, but I don't think I'll get a lot of people to say, okay, here's my $28 this week or month or whatever.
Well, you bring that up. The Sun-Times is like $30 a year for digital access to the Sun-Times, which is too low, I think. I mean, it's just too low. I think the paper needs more. They're subsisting right now a lot on the philanthropic help that they got in making the transition to join WBEZ. I don't know how long the Sun-Times can keep going at $30 a year, but it does seem like an investment like that you would make, as John points out, in the Art Institute, the Lyric Opera, if you support them, the Old Town School of Folk Music, those kind of places that just need this kind of constant support that can't make it just on the fees that they charge.
Yeah.
And that's the way the world works. And I think that's the way journalism is going to have to go, that you're going to have more institutions that are supported by donations like ProPublica and Justice Watch. Block Club charges a subscription fee. I think it's, what is it, $70 a year or something like that? I mean, it's I'm glad to pay it. I think Block Club Chicago is a great asset. It's a great resource to the city, and I'm really glad they're there because they're covering stories that the bigger papers aren't covering.
What is the premium edition of the Picayune Sentinel cost?
$50 a year.
And how many people are subscribing to that? You don't have to answer that, but I'm curious.
No, I've got about 12,500 subscribers to the subscribers and something like 1,500 paid subscribers.
I'm really encouraged by that, Eric. I think that's great.
Yeah, I am too. Yeah, yeah, I'm happy with it. So,
yeah.
And I wanted when I started off, I was thinking like I should charge less, but Substack doesn't let you charge less, and that's the lowest Substack.
Oh, really? Really? Yeah. But you know, it is interesting, isn't it? That so now I've got Axios, and I've got Eric's Picayune Sentinel, and I've got Block Club Chicago. I've got all these little, I don't want to call them niche sites, but it's not the big mastheads. Sun-Times, Tribune, WGN. It's all of these other little ways that you pick and choose to get your information. I'm not sure what's the better model for us.
It's like television now, right? You want to get Hulu and Peacock and Apple TV and all these different outlets. I think your point, though, about the niche publications, I think you also want to... I also want to support and do the Washington Post, New York Times, Atlantic. Atlantic Monthly, these national publications that do some very deep dives into important topics. So you are choosing your own media digest, those of us who can afford to do so.
That can afford to do so is, we've talked on in the past, Marge, you weren't on the podcast when we did, but we have spent some time talking about how these newspapers could monetize clicks. There's lots of times, what was it I was trying to go to today? I don't subscribe to Washington Post. I did, and I wanted to read an article, and I couldn't get past the paywall. If they had said, okay, they had some offer for me to read the article, but I want them to charge me a penny for that read or a dime. I would have given them a dime. If I had a credit card on file and I could read the Denver Post, pick the newspapers around the country or magazines, I can't subscribe to them all, but I would pay them for the read, and I don't need to, but I would pay them for the clicks. There's no system set up like that.
What they really should be doing is the YouTube model, right? You go to watch something on YouTube, you have to watch an ad before your video starts. Okay, fine. So places I don't subscribe to, like John, like the Washington Post, I'd be happy to watch an ad pop up on my screen that they would obviously get paid for showing me in order to read the article. It's hard to understand why they're not doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is like a debate that I've heard for years in the theater community. You're married to the subscription model. It's money up front. It gives you some operating capital. And the idea of going show by show makes a lot of companies nervous. With good reason. And yet somebody like Second City, you can't subscribe to them. And they're a for-profit successful business. So it's a leap you have to take away from the subscriber model.
Hmm.
But your idea is one way to supplement, and there are others. But I think it's hard to take the mindset away from the way historically they made money.
And it might be that you could do something like have it so that if you live in, say, the Chicago metro area, you could not have a YouTube-style access.
You could geofence us outside.
So you say that if you're coming in from Denver and you want to read an article in the Chicago Tribune about Mayor Johnson because you're curious about that, then you've got to watch an ad. But if you're in Chicago, you have to be a subscriber to read more than whatever it is, 10 articles a month, something like that. But yeah, I mean, this is a problem that's been vexing this industry for 20 years now, ever since the internet began just eating its lunch. And I don't have a lot of optimism about the future of print journalism. I don't think that in a couple of years we're going to have daily print products delivered to doorsteps. I just think that those people who get those products delivered every day to their house are dying off. I mean, it is not something that – I mean, my kids are – in their 20s and early 30s, and they don't subscribe to a daily newspaper. They get all their news on their phones and their computers, and they're not like weirdos. This is how people are getting their information these days.
And a lot of times they're getting it for free too.
Yeah, they are. But I don't see this idea of killing a bunch of trees and then putting the ink on paper and then delivering it to your doorstep 8 to 12 hours later is going to survive. You get the Tribune in the morning. It doesn't have the evening sports scores from the night before. And at some point, people are going to say, like, this isn't the way we do things in the 2020s.
As long as the Tribune journalists write news and do their job, we shouldn't worry about how they get that information on their phone, on their tablet, in a newspaper printed on paper, as long as that exists. It's what the AM radio industry is facing. We don't care, at least I don't, if you listen to me on a radio. What if you listen to me on a phone or on a computer or on your streaming service? You say, hey, Siri, play WGN radio. I was told, I can't verify this sitting here, but more of our listeners now listen to us on the stream than do on radios. People are getting them from smart speakers more than on dashboards or home units.
Again, this has been going on for 20 years. They're trying to figure out a way, can you make internet digital delivery of the news as profitable as ink on paper delivery of the news?
Should Joe Biden do a Super Bowl interview? CBS has offered him a 15-minute conversation to be posted or streamed online. A few minutes of it would then be broadcast on TV before the game. For the second year in a row, the president has said no thank you. His aides say voters are exhausted from the campaigns, such as they are already, and they just want to watch the game. Seeing the president during the festivities will turn them off. It is a campaign opportunity that they don't want. At least that's one way to put it. Another way is they're afraid he's going to do badly. What's your advice to Joe Biden?
If I'm a Joe Biden campaign strategist, and unfortunately, that means I don't have the guts to tell him he shouldn't be running anymore. So instead, I would tell him, don't do this interview. Please don't do this interview. I mean, clearly, they know him. And that's what they're telling him, right? I mean, so those of us out here have a spectrum of opinion on whether or not we think he's doing well or not based on the last time we saw a snippet of him on the news. And some people will say, oh, he looks just fine. And other people will say, well, didn't you see him, you know, at this event when he said this or that? Clearly, they're limiting his appearances, and they know what his abilities are. So that must be what his abilities are.
Right. So that's the right answer. The right answer would be don't do it because they've determined that he's not actually up to it, which is funny because it's Gayle King, Marge. It's not Sean Hannity sitting there. It's not Tucker Carlson he's going to sit down with. Gayle will throw him some softballs. It's not a time for any gotcha stuff. What would you say?
I think it's not, I would not jump to the conclusion that they said no because they didn't think he could handle it. I would say no to him if I were advising him because you will be airing the clips, however safe the interview is, to a stadium where half the people are not supporting you, half the people in this country, and they'll be drunk. So I don't think you want to hear the president's best comments. And I would trust that he could say some really good things.
Well, I disagree with Marge, and I agree in part with Kate. I think he should definitely do it if he is up to being president for another 4.5 years. If he's seriously up for doing that, then he ought to be up to talking to Gayle King before the Super Bowl. It's a huge audience, and if he could appear on an interview like that and come off as competent and non-demented and non-senescent, then he ought to do it because that's a big part of his problem right now, which is that people think he's too old. And if he can come on as someone who speaks clearly, thoughtfully, knows his stuff, then that will go some distance in erasing this idea that he's not capable of being president. If his campaign people think he can't handle Gayle King before the Super Bowl for 15 minutes, then he really ought to get out of the race. I mean, I wish that he would. Honestly, I still wish that he would. I think he's done a good job.
How do you think it would go? I think you wish that he would be good at it. Do you think he would be good at it?
I think he could be. I think it might depend on
Your Honor. He's avoiding the question.
Honestly, well, yes, I think he probably would be. I think he would be prepared. He's going to have to do some debates, unless Trump doesn't want to debate him. He's going to have to do some debates, and debates are a lot more stressful, a lot more. I mean, debates are going to be 90 minutes where you're getting hostile questions and you're confronted with your adversary. This is Gayle King talking to Joe Biden, saying, Joe, you know, people are, and she'll ask some somewhat difficult questions. She's not going to ask softball questions, but she's not going to get into an argument with him. And if he can't handle that, then what's he doing running for president?
I don't think he can handle it, or his people would be having him do this. And I don't know his exact record here, but I think we all know he's not holding the kind of press conferences and the kind of one-on-one interviews that we're used to seeing. And that's why. And that's what I'm saying. They know what his abilities are, and they're not letting him do this.
I draw a different conclusion, but I will say this. If I worked for him, I would not only tell him don't do it, I would be reaching out to try to negotiate for Taylor Swift to appear with him. She's a supporter. Let's do the interview with Taylor Swift, and you know it'll go well. Except that half the stadium doesn't like her anymore either. That's another problem.
Trump has already challenged him to a debate. Trump has already challenged him to a debate, which, of course, they were able to, you know, laugh off. Oh, come on. You know, it's still the primaries. You know, picking up on what you were saying, Eric, that debates will be worse. I actually think that they are going to come up with reasons for him not to do the debates, because absolutely he will not be able to.
I would not do many. Well, I would not do many.
Trump won't do that well either. Trump is not hitting on all cylinders himself these days.
So I know, but he is out there doing these public appearances and extemporaneous talking. He wants
Trump would steamroll him.
He's incoherent half the time. He is a disaster in a debate against somebody who actually has facts, which I guess I have more faith in Biden than either of you do. I really feel that he has plenty on the ball and could certainly handle a debate and could certainly handle a Gayle King interview. Again, I think there's other reasons why they want to pace his public appearances. Why would they,
but this is like a free ad. It's like 15 minutes in front of how many millions, tens, hundreds of millions of viewers?
Yeah.
It's 15 free minutes. How do you turn that down?
Sports audience is not a news audience. It's not a political audience. I think it's a negative place to be speaking.
I think a lot could go wrong, at least with this president in that situation. Safe as it is, I don't share Eric's enthusiasm for Joe Biden's ability to handle something like this well. Were he Barack Obama, who did these things really well? Yeah. Donald Trump said no 1 year. Maybe the last thing to consider, though, when you ask yourself about this is not can Joe Biden handle it or is it good politics for him, but do people want it? I don't know that it would be missed. I don't even know that it would be conspicuous by its absence, because at the football parties, everybody's walking around. There's a lot of noise. They're all eating chips and nobody's going, hey, where's that 3 minute clip of Joe Biden from the 15 minutes that CBS recorded with Gayle King before the game? It's a non-issue if he doesn't do it. I think the risk outweighs the benefit.
For anybody who doesn't have some issues going on, though, how could it be a risk to sit down with Gayle?
Right. Well, the audience.
Every communication decision is based on the audience.
And you're a communications pro, so Marge's advice to him, knowing who he is and what it would be...
Don't do it without Taylor.
The half of the audience that you think might boo Taylor Swift is a half of the audience that wouldn't vote for Joe Biden anyway.
That's right.
If you're playing for the middle, the new voters, the young voters, the suburban moms, I don't know who else Taylor picks up that Joe Biden doesn't already get. But I think that would be a net positive if he could get that, as contrived as that would appear. I mean, all the people who think there's a conspiracy out there about Taylor Swift, that would be their moment of truth. I told you so, they'd say.
Yeah, I told you so. Is progressive and liberal and going to vote Democratic? We know that.
You know, the challenge in this election is not going to be able to, is not talking Trump supporters away from their support of Trump. That's not going to happen. I've certainly dealt with some of them online. You can't shame them out of supporting Trump. They like, I don't know what they like exactly about Trump, but they do like him and they like his attitude. They like that he is misogynist creep. I don't know what it is they like about him, but they do really like him. The goal of this campaign has got to be to excite and inspire these younger voters, people who are who tend to be some of the ethnic minority voters who tend to vote Democratic, who are wavering, who are sitting on the fence, who are just disengaged. It's going to be about firing up your base, getting them out to vote, making sure that people realize the stakes of the election, because you're not going to talk Trump supporters out of supporting Trump. You know, like the Lincoln Project tries to do. It's just not going to happen.
Eric came on our radio show and also opined on his Picayune Sentinel, something about whether or not the Chicago Board of Education should be a body of people who are voted on or appointed by the mayor. The new law in Illinois now says that the Chicago Board of Education will be an elected body, maybe in two tranches. Eric was actually wondering if we just ought to vote for everybody all at once and just get the thing over with. But in principle, I think Eric and I ended up in different places. I'm wondering what our panel thinks about should a Board of Education, maybe the Chicago Board of Education, the second largest student body in the country, should that be appointed by the mayor? Should that be the mayor's job? Or should it be an elected body?
Rich Daley took that on.
I still don't know why he would want that. I still don't know why a mayor would even want that responsibility.
At the time, everybody was really impressed with him for being willing to take that on. And it was kind of taken as a, oh, wow, you know, if he wants this responsibility, he must really, he's willing to wear the jacket. You know, things are going to get done. We're going to have great schools now. Well, you know, for people who are very much in favor of school choice, of course, he did basically usher in the current era of the magnet schools and get some more high quality high school magnet schools together. And the charters too. But so your question, John, we don't have this choice, right? It was passed in Springfield back in 2021, I think. So it's going to happen. We're going to have an elected school board, but you still want to argue the point of whether or not we should?
Eric's point is a little more nuanced. It's in what order, you know, should we do them all at once or in these two groups? But I just wonder what did you think about that? I don't like the idea of a mayor having that much authority. I'm not sure that him wearing the jacket is necessarily going to make the schools better.
When they passed this law, they did make it so that we're starting out with a hybrid system.
Yeah.
At least the way it is right now, it's supposed to be that we're going to elect, we're going to have 20 or 21?
21, and we'll elect 10 at first.
Yeah, and right. So initially, only 10 will be elected, and the other 10 will still be Brandon Johnson appointees. And then
plus the head of the board, right?
Plus the head of the board. He gets to appoint the president. Anyway, and then in 2 years, then we elect the other 10 members of the school board. Johnson was actually one of the people negotiating this back in 2021 when he worked for CTU. They wanted it to be all elected right away. But as I'm sure Eric talked about, the deal now is that they would really like it to be CTU and Brandon Johnson now want to keep that hybrid system because now he's in power, which means CTU is in power. So they'd like to keep those 10 appointments.
I'm not in favor of 100% elected school board. I was the communications director at Chicago Public Schools during what they called the United Nations Board. I think we had 15. It was ponderous at best to sit through a meeting. You had a representative of the Muslim community that complained about pork in the cafeterias. You had legitimately Latino representatives who had overcrowded schools at the time and nothing was being done about it. You had to, for every issue, listen to all the constituencies, relevant or not, to that issue. And very little got done. I'm going to say very little got done. Electing individual members based on a local constituency, I don't think is the best thing for a citywide body like this. I'd like to see it blown up. I'd like to see small districts. I think it's too big. The fact that you're going to have 20 board members, it is crazy. And it indicates just how big this district is and how diverse our city is in their education needs and how I think that we suffer from having this one giant school board. Daley's feeling at the time, as I understood it, was he's going to wear the jacket anyway. Mm-hmm. So let him have actual control, because what was happening, the circus that was going on at the board, he didn't have anything to do with it. He didn't have any accountability. Half the members, if not a majority, were elected, were appointed by the governor. It was just hard to get agendas to mesh in favor of the children.
How does the mayor exert any influence then? Does the mayor then kind of work it backwards for me? So you're the mayor, and you're now responsible for the performance of kids in the classrooms. How does a good mayor get better scores? I could see not voting for him because it was bad and you were mad, but I just wonder if that's the right person to be making any decisions on behalf of the schools. What decisions would he make? How does his influence extend down to the classrooms to actually make a difference? Like, okay, you're my education mayor. I'm going to vote for you. What could he do?
It depends on who he appoints to his school board, and it depends on who he appoints to be his superintendent. His or hers, it could, you know, obviously the mayor could end up being a woman, will end up being a woman someday, I'm sure again. The problem, I mean, I pointed this out to you before in this, which is that when you have these elected school boards, first of all, one of the reasons that the Chicago Teachers Union doesn't want immediate elections of all of the school board members, first for the reason that Kate said, is why would they want to do that when they've got a former member of their lobbying team as mayor? They've got the control they want right now. They don't need an election. All that's going to happen in an election is they're going to lose power. So they're not interested in that. But the other thing is that in order to field 20 candidates, it's going to take a lot more money than fielding 10 candidates. And they're not ready for that yet. They don't have the people in place. They're gearing up for 10 elections, not 20. And so what happens in places like Los Angeles, which is the biggest school district that has elections, I believe, literally tens of millions of dollars get poured into these races from all over the country, from advocates of charter schools and voucher programs on one side to teachers union people on the other side. And these become these incredible proxy wars over education policy. And of course, the voters don't clue into these things. Voters tend to be low turnout elections, and voters are bombarded by ads. And it becomes kind of this grubby political system. I would rather have one person be ultimately responsible for the performance of the schools, judge him or her the way you want to, and say, okay, Mayor Emanuel, Mayor Daley, Mayor Lightfoot has been good, has been bad for the schools. I want to hold him or her to account for that. I want a different superintendent. I want different policies here. But to try to say, okay, I've got to go figure out, first of all, what district do I live in? Yeah. Who's my school board representative? Yet. And are they going to be responsive to me? Whose tune are they dancing to? What if I live in a district that's elected someone who's like wildly pro-voucher and I'm anti-voucher? What's that person going to listen to me? Is there a way that I can express myself on that? So I'm really skeptical of it. I mean, I like democracy. I really do. But I just feel like in this case, the democratic answer, the small d democratic answer, is to hold a mayor accountable, someone who you know, someone whose performance you can evaluate.
I agree. I think it's going to be an absolute mess. I mean, we all believe in democracy, but we're all so sick of campaigning and political ads. And now we're laying on top of what we already have a whole nother set. And so now we're going to be electing everyone we're already electing, then throw on the school board members, and then you got local school councils, and now we've got the local smaller police councils. I mean, come on. People don't have time, just like with judges. Mm-hmm. But at least with judges, you can go rip out from the newspaper the list of judges recommended by the Bar Association and just use that. But that's supposed to be neutral and not political. This will be completely different. You were saying, John, like, what can the mayor do? Like, right now, we've got the issue of school choice. Johnson wants to change the system that we currently have now. And there's, you know, right or wrong, I'm not even necessarily going to advocate one way or another, but that is a gigantic issue. Do people no longer want to have choice in where their kids go to school? Do they want to only have the choice of their neighborhood school? That's what he wants to do. And his current appointees, that's what they have said they're setting the current five-year plan to be before an elected school board even gets put in place.
Well, and there's also the issue of cops in schools, which is apparently right. quite urgent right these days. They're going to make a decision very soon about that, about whether local schools, high schools and middle schools, I guess, can have Chicago police officers in them. And the mayor seems to be telling his school board that he wants them to ban the use of police officers in schools. And then you see stories like, I think it was Taft High School, where they surveyed the parents and the community, and they found out that like 80% of them think that having a resource officer in the school is a good idea. So why shouldn't that be a local decision? And this is a decision that is coming from the mayor and his handpicked school board. And we can hold the mayor responsible for that. If this were a school board of diffuse people whose names we probably don't know, because we don't even know who our particular district representative is, it becomes one of these things like decisions that just get made that you don't have any control over.
Well, but so you don't. I mean, the mayor is going to be in office for 4 years, and you've elected this guy because you thought he was going to be good on real estate taxes or crime or whatever. But now he's the education's are too, and education is going to be a function of his view of the thing. Maybe this sounds naive, but I would prefer that people have a say in that on these issues per se, where you would elect school board members who reflect your opinion on it. And Eric, if you live in the wrong district, welcome to democracy. There are some Republicans in Chicago, too, you know. I'm surprised that you guys, who I don't think are all great fans of everything that Brandon Johnson is doing, are happy to hand him the keys and say, okay, you drive the bus now.
Does anybody anywhere have an ongoing, always hybrid school board where the mayor gets to appoint half and the other half are elected? Because that could potentially even things out.
That sounds like a compromise, doesn't it? That's not the plan, but for 2 years we'll have that. Marge, what were you going to say?
First, to your last point, I don't think anyone who voted for Brandon Johnson is surprised to see he has a particular point of view about education. I mean, we knew that about him, I think, when the election happened. The question that relates to Kate's point about choice, not choice in the sense of vouchers, let's be clear, but your ability to apply for your right. child to go to another
right.
public school in a different neighborhood or nearby, whatever you want. This is an example, and I think the same with the police in the schools, where there's an aspirational decision that doesn't match operational capacity. So right now, many neighborhood schools are inadequate. They're not teaching a quality education. Sadly, they're in those neighborhoods that are underserved in many different ways. So if you abruptly make that switch, you're hurting the students who most need to move. On the other hand, those are the students who take least advantage of the opportunity. Let's educate the parents about what the options are and how to find the right school. Even among two good schools, you can have a feeling about which your child is better suited to because of the atmosphere, because of various things that have to do with your child's personality. So having that opportunity to match your child to a school, I think, is a benefit. If all the schools were grade A schools, you wouldn't need to move so much. But we're not there yet. And I think that decision and the decision about police, I'm not in favor of police in schools, and I wouldn't want that in my child's school. But if parents do, they would have reasons for that, and they should be able to. But I think that accountability to the mayor, there's no substitute for it.
Speaking of narrow margins, I'm thinking about the vote in the Congress today.
It was 216 to 24. It was two votes the impeachment motion lost by two votes. And this was on Tuesday, I think.
They were literally pulling them out of hospital beds and wheeling them in there, or not showing up and surprising them when they thought they had the votes. So that's Mike Johnson's embarrassment now. Maybe the Congress was just too busy trying to impeach the Homeland Secretary to bother with border protection. But when Joe Biden essentially called right-wing Republicans bluff and gave them much of what they had asked for, they still turned it down after 4 months of daily negotiations. Senate Democrats handed them the power to close the border when as few as 4,000 migrants showed up on any given day. That's less than half of the daily surge we've seen lately. And the end of catch and release, 4,000 plus new asylum officers to process claims more quickly, tougher standards for asylum claims, work permits for those who get a positive determination on their status. Wouldn't that be great? If you are determined to be here legally or rightfully, then in fact you would get a work permit. That was part of the bill. Aid to some organizations providing resources to some migrants. Maybe that's one thing that some Republicans didn't like, but if you scored this, this was on paper a win for Republicans. The House said it would be dead on arrival. Senators got cold feet, and now nothing's going to happen with what the Wall Street Journal said was the toughest migration bill in decades. The Washington Post said something like, this is what happens when the dog catches the car. It's like, oh, now what am I going to do with this thing? And they are turning it down. Doggone it, this was a real golden opportunity. And I guess it's just for the simple reason that Donald Trump and Mike Johnson don't want it. And so it's not going to happen. What a lost opportunity.
I say good riddance to the opportunity. They caved in too much.
They gave too much. And by the way, on the other side was aid to Ukraine. Well, it was going to be aid to Ukraine, aid to the Israelis, aid to Palestinians, etc. But those were some of the principles, at least on the immigration front. That's where the battle was largely being fought. And you think that the president and the Democrats were giving too much there. What would you have asked for, Marge, that they did not get? Or what were they giving away that you wish they hadn't?
I think they made an arbitrary limitation on asylum claims based on X number. You know, you could show up at the border with a legitimate claim. I'm sorry, you know, 500 people were in front of you. You can't come in now. I think that arbitrariness is not the American way. It's not the Ellis Island theory and of welcoming all with open arms that our country's always been. They're building a portion of the wall in there, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, I just think they just took the whole GOP platform. They gave up on Dreamers. They, you know, this is not a Democratic. There's no compromise in there.
Dick Durbin said he was going to
hold your nose and accept.
That's what Dick Durbin said he was going to do. And he's the DACA guy. Even Dick Durbin, though, was going to vote for it, Marge.
Because I know he was. And I don't think he should. And meanwhile, what about the root question? There's two root questions. A, Trump says, no, I want to run on this. I want the border to be as chaotic as possible throughout the election. And the GOP elected Congress people who are representing what's good for the country say, okay, boss, we're going to keep it and we're going to make it as big a mess as we can at the border. And we're going to complain about what a mess it is. So they gave into that. But secondly, what is happening with aid to Ukraine? Why is Tucker Carlson in Moscow? Is he getting a Putin interview?
Yes.
He's there.
Yes.
It looks like he is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And why is the GOP, led by the Putin friend in chief, so set on making Russia more powerful?
Well, do you think the play here is bad then for the Republicans? Because the Democrats, like you said, Marge, gave in too much. They completely compromised. If it's border security you want, they gave it to them at their own risk. And Republicans still said no. So it does make the point that Republicans are not interested. This is the Wall Street Journal. They said, do Republicans just want more chaos until the election, or do they want border security? They're answering it by their failure on this bill. Maybe that's a win then for the Democrats, even if they don't get what they want.
I mean, the problem is that immigration, this whole situation at the border, is really a drag on the Democratic Party right now. There's a sense that the border is out of control, and I'm not sure how to evaluate those claims. I am not down there, but certainly, you know, the migrant situation in Chicago gives a sense that there is not a control. We're not securing our borders. There are lots of people coming, sort of rushing across the border, and they're not stopping enough of them. And so, I mean, there's a real sense that this is an extreme liability for Democrats. And for some reason, people who are in parts of the country that are not affected by this at all are particularly energized by,
yeah,
by immigration.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I would hate to call anybody racist, but it does seem like this is not a kind of concern that we had when a bunch of people from Ukraine were coming in, for instance, refugees from the war there. So my guess is that this bill was crafted by Democrats who looked at a lot of internal polling numbers and said, how are we going to mute this issue, blunt this issue for Democrats, and have it be so that voters will think of the Democrats as being part of the solution. And this seems like a really good it was a good poker play on their part. The fact that the Republicans have nixed it indicates that they don't really care about the border at all. They care about it as an issue. Donald Trump had 2 years where he had both houses of Congress and the presidency, and he didn't do much about immigration. It's like, you know, he wanted to build the wall. So Mexico's going to pay for the wall. It's all nonsense. So he wants the issue. He wants to be able to hammer Biden on immigration. I get letters from conservatives all the time talking about this. And that was what they tried to do. I'm not sure why they have to put immigration and Ukraine and Israel all into the same bill. You can't do that like in Illinois. They don't allow bills to be all jammed together where you have a bunch of different, you know, you like this, but you got to take these two pills that you don't like.
Only way you were going to get your aid to Ukraine, though, Eric.
Right. Well, but you know, that to lump them all together, you know, is like, you know, you're sort of putting the medicine into the applesauce, right? And that's I don't think that's the way it should go. I think that people should vote up or down on various on individual initiatives and not on a whole package of things that it's a half of which you don't like.
That's what they're going to do next, right? They're bringing the aid votes on the Senate side. They're bringing them to the floor
separately. I would like that, too. It would be easy to be cynical and say, well, that's a terrible thing if you're horse trading on these all important issues. They shouldn't be linked together. But that is what happens. The interests are all legitimate. The border, Israel, Ukraine. And if I have strong feelings about one thing and you have strong feelings about the other, maybe it's not unreasonable to expect us to compromise some of our values in dollars so that we get something else we want in exchange. That's politics. That's not a bad thing.
Maybe you're right. I know that there's a real movement in the Democratic circles to really hammer on this, and I hope that it works, that you're able to pull some people who are in the middle on immigration, who are concerned about immigration, and are concerned about the way Biden's handled it, but don't necessarily want to give everything over to Donald Trump because of that. If you can convince them that Biden made a good faith effort to meet them halfway or more than halfway, if you know, in Marge's take on it, that this would make them realize that in fact the Democratic position is more reasonable and something that they would want to follow.
Rob Wharton had a great idea in the letter that you published in the Tuesday Picayune Sentinel. What Trump should do is come out with a public statement saying that it's not true that he told the Republicans to vote against the immigration bill. He didn't say that. He's all for it. And, you know, so it's still all Joe Biden's fault that it didn't happen somehow. He really wants to, you know, still have that border security.
He's already on record doubling down and saying, blame me. I'm happy to spike that bill, he said.
He's Trump, though. He could do that. It's a fabulous idea from Rob Wharton because he could totally get away with it. But what it made me think of when I read it was, you know, Biden right now is being quoted saying, okay, fine, they voted it down. And now for the entire campaign, I'm going to be saying it's all Trump's fault. It's all the Republicans' fault. What's going on at the border right now? But the Republicans all this time have also been saying that he could do most of this himself without a vote of Congress.
Boy, I haven't heard that spin on it or that. So he could appropriate money for all of those other asylum officers.
He can't appropriate his own money, so I know he can't appropriate money as they were doing in that bill, but presidents have been doing things under their, you know, making their presidential rulings on what they're going to do at the border. They do have a lot of latitude.
There is some news coverage. I'm looking quickly at an AP story that says without changes to immigration law or more funding to manage the growing number of asylum seekers, there isn't much Biden can do that will really stick.
I'm reading from the Wall Street Journal editorial. By any honest reckoning, this is the most restrictive migrant legislation in decades. Previous immigration talks have involved trading security measures for legalizing more immigration. There is little of the latter in this bill. Nothing for nearly all of the Dreamers who were brought here illegally as children. No general pathway to citizenship for green cards. All those things the Democrats always wanted, they're not asking for, just so they can get the aid for Ukraine and movement in these other areas. They're giving it's why Marge doesn't like it. They're giving away the store here. I think a lot of times we say, okay, fine, then give them that. And then just get the thing done. They gave them that. Mike Johnson said, this is even worse than we thought it would be. I thought, talk about just being able to say anything with no tether to the truth. The 78, that parcel of land where the White Sox are going to go. Marge, was that something that you wrote to the Sun-Times about this week?
It is. I had a letter in the Monday Sun-Times suggesting this is yet another area where City Hall could be far more transparent. But it's not just this administration. It's a tradition going back pretty far where the deals are done with developers in private. The negotiations to some extent need to be private, but not entirely. And they could have some public input up front with some basic criteria. For instance, I'd like to hear the mayor say, yeah, we're talking with them, we're negotiating details, but don't worry, there will be no public financing because I won't allow it because I know the taxpayers don't want that. I'd like to hear that, for example, also from local aldermen, of which we have several, although it's in Third Ward Alderman Pat Dowell's ward, but many area aldermen. We have five in the near south area where I live. So what happens always is they negotiate the deal. They come out with a big slick presentation, and then they hold a couple town halls where people can speak. Or the way Lightfoot used to do it, you couldn't speak, but you could write a thing down on a card and turn it in. And the people running the meeting would read it if they wanted, or as I actually saw with the card I submitted once on the casino question, start to read it, then pause and edit it as they go along because they didn't want to say what I actually was saying. So there's no public input of any meaning that happens after the deal is done.
But what's happening with this proposed White Sox deal where they would move to the South Loop? What has happened so far that you feel they aren't being sufficiently transparent about?
Well, the mayor and Third Ward Alderman Pat Dowell have suggested this will be a good deal. Dowell has added a clause saying there needs to be discussion about traffic patterns, environmental impact, what happens with guaranteed rate field, which is a huge question for the city. You know, we're facing the prospect, if you believe that the Bears are interested in the South lot as a potential site for a new stadium, and I don't know if we believe that, but if you do, we could end up with an abandoned stadium, two abandoned stadiums, basically across the road from each other. And what are we going to do with it? We're left holding, not only holding the bag on a vacant site, but the financial bag, because we the taxpayers, owe $50 million on the current Sox Park and $640 million on Soldier Field on a bond issue that actually was under $400 million to begin with. But because it was refinanced repeatedly by prior mayors, it's now ballooned up to $640 million. So we owe about $700 million combined on these two stadiums that could be empty shells in a matter of time if the mayor thinks that's a good idea to negotiate and that rams it through the city council.
Right. That would be a scenario where the Bears go to Arlington Heights, the Sox move to the South Loop, and those other two properties are sitting there without a team in either of them. The Bears pay a penalty, though, if they leave early, right? But not enough to make up for the difference on that bond.
Representative Cam Buckner has suggested and I think put forward a bill that I don't believe has passed, but it's, you know, waiting committee, suggesting that if they're going to go to Arlington Heights, any state impetus or involvement in that should include a requirement that they pay off the remainder of the financing on the old site.
So you're not saying should the Sox go to the South Loop, but you're just saying whatever they decide to do should be more in the open. I read the mayor and the alderman's comments as just being opining, like we all are, about it in general. You make it sound as though stuff is actually transpiring. Things are actually taking place behind closed doors. Is that also true?
Well, we've seen leaked drawings, only leaked, that no one will confirm. I am one of the organizers of a community group here in the near south, and we've invited both Related Midwest, which is the developer in charge of the 78, and Alderman Dowell to come separately or together to come talk to us about what is being discussed. And they've both said it's premature. They want to nail a deal before they come talk to anybody. And That'll be too late. The train will have left the station and we've all been railroaded.
You know that they're making their deals. I see what you mean, John, that I guess you can take what Mayor Johnson has said so far and also Pat Dowell as just being encouraging. But one thing for sure is that Brandon Johnson is immediately accepting the concept of the 78 because he said nothing about, well, maybe we should look at keeping them in Bridgeport and redeveloping over there. So he immediately has taken that step to 78 is fine. And just bypass that entire public conversation. And, you know, I know I already said it, but I do feel like it's a complete insult to the South Side in Bridgeport.
I get that. I get that.
Let that happen. It should be a public conversation at least first.
But I think the greatest injury would not be, well, too bad for the South Side, or we should have more input on some of the stadium details, as it might be the financing of it. If the somehow some deal emerged where the state or the city were picking up the tab for Jerry Reinsdorf again, for crying out loud. Yeah. Shame on us.
That's exactly the point. And I and my neighbors are not expressing opposition to the idea of having the Sox in 78, but we've had enough of public financing for stadiums, privately owned or not. We don't necessarily want to be stuck with another stadium either. We don't necessarily want to own a new stadium. But meanwhile, there is, and I've talked about this before too, this one central development that's out there in the ether, which would be the 30 acres between McCormick Place and Soldier Field, basically only across the street on the west side of Lakeshore Drive, where a private developer has won legislative approval for $6.5 billion with a B in taxpayer subsidy for infrastructure for that project. And if the Bears are truly looking at the South Lot as a location for a new stadium, you can bet One Central will be part of the deal and that money will be back on the table. Well, it is on the table. No one's taken it away. The governor has to approve it. He's ordered a feasibility study trying to slow walk the thing, but it's out there. So how many billions of dollars are we going to spend for private development?
Brandon Johnson does not want to be the mayor who lost the Bears. Right. He or the White Sox, for that matter. The White Sox could go to the suburbs. It could go to Nashville. He doesn't want to be that mayor. On the other hand, he's going to use almost certainly our money, our taxpayer money, to for the infrastructure improvements that are needed around a stadium like that.
Which is a legitimate use of public money. It's a public.
It can be. There are interesting studies. I think it's Alan Sanderson at the University of Chicago who's done studies about the impact of these stadiums, and he studies Olympics and things like that. And most of these things tend to be boondoggles that they don't end up enriching a city or making a city a better place to live or boosting the bottom line.
You don't think that having the Bears and the White Sox in Chicago makes Chicago a better place to live?
Oh, it does, for sure. The question is, does it pay off? I mean, of course, you bring people in, traveling people come in, they stay at the hotels and so on. Yes, absolutely. They do. That boosts the bottom line. The question is, where did that bottom line start after all the investment that we put into it? If the Bears abandon Soldier Field, you're going to have this shell of a stadium that they say, oh, we can use it for more outdoor concerts. I mean, honestly, that's not – Soldier Field will be a white elephant. People are very sentimental about it because it's a memorial to fallen soldiers. So they're not going to tear it down, which they probably just should. If they're going to build another stadium there, they ought to just build another stadium there and raise that and have it be parkland. I would really like to see these – teams which make lots and lots of money and these leagues that make lots of money invest in their own damn stadiums for the most part. Now, yeah, if you want infrastructure around the perimeter, okay, maybe we can talk about that. But actually helping them build a stadium? I don't think so. Not anymore. I don't like the idea.
I don't know
how we get our money's worth, to your point, Eric, when we've got nearly $700 million already, invested in the existing stadiums. And also, when the Lucas Museum was proposed, wasn't there an environmental issue that if they dig up that south lot, there was some environmental issue with the site?
I thought the big issue was the charter itself, that they shouldn't be developing the land on that side, right?
It's a little bit of both.
I have not read or heard much about whether is Los Angeles glad that it has.
I was wondering that. Is that all that in a bag of chips? I haven't followed up on how great it is.
The museum itself did not sound all that enticing to me, frankly. It's like you get to walk through and see memorabilia from the filming of these movies. Now, I'm not a Star Wars geek.
And I think it was going to be more than that, but that's what it always sounded like. But that was the problem. I don't think they ever sold it to us. I don't know if it was a good idea anyway, but I think the pitch was always bad on that, Eric.
Well, let's research that, and for the next episode, someone will get back to us on whether it was a good idea.
And real quick, I will say there was an environmental concern, which I did double check my memory on that. Some chemicals based dating back to the Chicago fire.
Wow. And then they moved them to Brighton Park, I believe, is where they took all those chemicals and put them. The best picture nominees for the Oscars are American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, Zone of Interest. That's not news, but Kate had an idea, and I think we all kind of like it, to just give our recommendations or thoughts about some of these between now and the Oscars itself. We won't dwell on all of them, but I think I've seen 6 of the 10 so far.
I think I've seen 6 also.
3.5. I'm slowly working my way through Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah,
you've got weeks. Take your time.
I've seen 3. I've seen Maestro, Oppenheimer, and Barbie.
Eric, on a scale of 1 to 23 Jujubes, what did you give Barbie? How much did you like that movie?
I like Barbie a lot. I thought I did maybe too. 19 Jujubes.
I watched the movie twice. I was entertained each time. I thought the performances were great. I'm not even into the whole controversy, legitimate as it is, about Greta Gerwig not getting a nomination and so forth. But I thought the movie was fun. You know, the lens through which I saw Barbie was that of a middle-aged white male, so maybe some of the messaging was either lost on me or was about me, but for the people who took more away from it than I did, what I got out of it was still fun. It was worth 2 views for me.
I enjoyed it. I saw it with a young woman who had a very different, it was her third time. She said, you know, if any time you want to go, I'll go with you. So
really?
I took her. She is, I think, 40-ish, late 30s probably. And she loved it more than I did, but she enlightened me. We stood on the sidewalk for about half an hour talking about it after the show. For me, I thought the feminism was stale because, like, if you didn't get that by, I mean, the America Ferrera speech was wonderful, but if you didn't get that by now in 2024, are you ever gonna? On the other hand, a lot of people who didn't get it got it out of Barbie. There's nothing wrong with that. And my younger friend felt very empowered to see that stated on the screen the way it was. And she was thrilled that that would be the message of a movie that would get so much attention. So I back it for that. Best picture, no. I don't think so. Entertaining, yes. Interesting, fun to watch. The director got slighted. If it's best picture, traditionally, how does the director not get a nomination? And my God, if
Margot Robbie
Holdovers is in there, then the bar is pretty low.
I agree with you on that. Margot Robbie didn't get nominated either. America Ferrera did, and for that speech, I would say, for that monologue she gave about feminism and the patriarchy. Kate, did you like the movie a lot?
I liked it, but now, what is the scale of what is the Jujube scale?
1 to 23.
What's the upper limit?
23 is high.
23 is the highest in the Jujube scale?
Affirmative, yes.
John gets to put in 13 of the Jujubes, and then you get the rest.
It's a hybrid system.
Okay, well, I guess I would give it in the vicinity of 15 Jujubes.
Wow.
I liked it. I think it was a lot of fun as a summer fun blockbuster. It was all that. I mean, Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling, all great. To Marge's point, that was my biggest problem with it, was that they were writing it as if we were still living in, instead of 2023 at that time, more like 1963 or 73.
83, 90.
Not even hardly 83.
Really? Because I felt that those issues were...
that's about the closest you could get. You could maybe say 83, but that's the closest you could get.
Those are more recent historical grievances, but they weren't current issues. That it, however resonant her speech was, it felt a little dated. Is that what you ladies are saying?
Well, yes and no. I mean, her speech obviously is...
Because I don't want to talk, because I know I don't know. That's the thing. I like. I thought she was pretty and he was funny. I thought it was a really fun movie and I thought, I don't know if this is working, but I know, and maybe that's the problem. I couldn't score that and it's about the me's of the world, but I felt like some of those issues just weren't clicking the way they would have 10, 20, 40 years ago, but I'm asking you ladies about that.
Yeah.
If I could put a spoiler alert out here. So if anybody listening, if you haven't seen it yet, turn it off for a second.
Okay.
Because it's the very end that got me. They had a big surprise for her and the big explosive benefit now that she's human. I didn't think she'd be getting a vagina, which is a nice thing for her, but I thought she'd be CEO of Mattel.
Something like that, too.
Yeah. And that was a letdown for me. She's just going to go away, you know, with her feminine sexuality, which is, you know, a good reward for being a human. But what happened to the power structure? They still going to be all men around the table at Mattel? They didn't learn anything. And neither did we, maybe.
Maybe that's asking the movie to do more than it was supposed to do, but maybe not. They went down that lane, right, Marge?
That's right.
They set this
up. Raised my expectations.
Yeah.
They weren't satisfied with saying we made a really fun, beautiful, well-acted,
clever,
funny movie. Yeah. They also wanted to be a huge political statement. But they're making a statement that is not radical, has not been radical for at least 40, 50 years. And also... the whole thing about the Barbie doll itself raising these crazy physical expectations for the girls who are playing with them. They brought up that issue. The America daughter herself voices that, you know, we hate you, Barbie. You always made us feel bad about ourselves. How is that solved? That's never solved.
How many jujubes from Marge and John on this? We have Kate and I have weighed in.
Yeah, what was your number again, Eric?
Mine was 19 and Kate's was 15.
I was 19.
You're 19.
I think
also?
I'll match Kate at 15.
Wow, okay. I can't help but note the way we've scored that. And now we've run out of time. We've spent a lot on it, but so we'll plow through a few more of these that we'll all go see. Maybe next week.
We could talk about Maestro and Holdovers together and the amount of time Barbie took.
Okay, we'll put those two for now. Maestro and the Holdovers. That's your assignment.
Where do we stream Holdovers?
On the streaming places.
I'm not sure, but it is available. Okay.
I'll give you my password if you need it, Eric.
All right. There we go.
Marge and Kate and Eric. A lot of time today. A lot of topics today. A lot of fun today. Thanks for being part of the Mincing Rascals podcast. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
See you guys. That was fun.
Ladies, there's a lot of time, and gentlemen.
You know, you use the word ladies, and, you know, I'm in my spare time, one of the things I do is I call square dances and barn dances, and there's a whole controversy in the traditional dance community about ladies and gents, and whether you refer to dancers as ladies and gents, because these are overly gendered terms, and they've been getting on the cases of some of us older traditional callers to change our terminology. Now we use larks and robins. Larks are gents and robins are ladies, and I can go into this whole thing, and it has roiled the traditional dance community in America for...
Are larks men, though? I mean, are they still gender specific?
Larks, and it's because, first of all, it fits better with calling. Larks and gents fits the rhythm of the calling better, and robins and ladies works better. And also, R is right, and ladies tend to be... ladies part is danced on the right. So Lark's on the left. And
why don't they just call it left and right and let people self-select?
Well, they do. They do let people self-select, and that's one of the things that gave rise to it, which was that there are a lot of non-binary people like to dance. A lot of people who there's some trans people who like to dance who don't like to be associated with one gender or the other, and there are also people who like to dance the other part. In this kind of dancing, the male part, the gents part, tends to be the lead. And the women's part tends to follow more. And if you want to dance the lead part, you have to be called a gent. And people didn't like that. And I've made the transition as a caller.
Larks and Robbins.
I do Larks and Robbins now. Yeah. Just take this off the podcast, but I was just saying.
This is the best thing we've done on the podcast. Are you kidding me? This is much better than what I was doing.
Anyway.
All right. We'll do another pod next week. Thank you, kids.
Enough of that.
Thank you, persons. Thank you, units.
Thanks, though.
Thank you, whatever you are.
Good to see y'all.
Yeah, bye. Human beings. Good job.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.